Chapter 9. That afternoon, Sean led his party across the steel railway bridge over the Tugela, on through the deserted village of Colenso, and out again across the plain. Far ahead, sown on the grass plain like a field of white daisies, were the tents of the great British encampment at Cheveley Siding. But long before he reached it, Sean came to a guard post manned by a sergeant and four men of an illustrious Yorkshire regiment.
"Hello, Pete. And where the hell do you think you're off to?"
"I'm a British subject," Sean informed them. The sergeant ran an eye over Sean's beard and patched coat. He glanced at the shaggy pony he rode, and then considered the direction from which Sean had approached.
"Say that again," he invited. "I am a British subject," Sean repeated obligingly, in an accent that fell heavily on the Yorkshireman's ear. "And I'm a ruddy Japanese," agreed the sergeant cheerfully. "Let's have your rifle, mate."
2 days Sean languished in the barbed wire prison compound while the intelligence department cabled the registrar of births at Ladyburg and waited for his reply. 2 long days during which Sean brooded incessantly, not on the indignities which had been inflicted on him, but on the woman he had found and loved and lost again so quickly. These 2 days of enforced inactivity came at precisely the worst moment. By repeating over and over in his imagination each word that had passed between them, by feeling again each contact of their hands and bodies, by forming her face in his mind's eye and gloating over every detail of it, Sean burned her memory so deeply into himself that it was there for all time. Although he did not even know her surname, he would never forget her. By the time he was released, with apologies, and given back his horses, rifle, money bag, and packs, Sean had driven himself into a mood of such overpowering depression that it could only be alleviated by liquor or physical violence. The village of Frere, which was the first station south on the line to the coast, promised both of these.
"Take Dirk with you," instructed Sean. "Beyond the town, find a camp beside the road and make a big fire, so I can find you in the dark."
"What will you do in Corsi?"
Sean started towards the dingy little canteen that catered for the thirst of Frere.
"I'm going there," he answered.
"Come, Nkosazana."
As he and Dirk continued on down the street, Mbijani was deciding how long he should give Sean before coming to fetch him. It was many years since the Nkosi had headed for a bar in such a determined fashion. But then there had been much to distress him these last few days. "He will need until midnight," Mbijani decided. "Then he will be in a condition conducive to sleep." From the door, Sean surveyed the interior of the canteen. A single large room with a trestle bar counter along the back wall. And the room was comfortably full of warmth and men and the smell of liquor and cigars. Still standing in the entrance, Sean slipped his hand into the pocket of his trousers and surreptitiously counted his money. 10 sovereigns he had allowed himself, more than sufficient for the purchase of the liquor he intended to consume. As he worked his way through the crowd towards the bar, he looked at the men about him, soldiers mostly, from 12 different regiments, colonials and imperial troops, other ranks predominating, although a party of junior officers sat at a table against the far wall. Then there were a few civilians whom he judged to be transport drivers, contractors and businessmen, 2 women with the officers, whose profession was never in doubt, and 12 black waiters.
"What'll it be, ducks?"
the large woman behind the counter asked as he reached it, and Sean regarded her moustache and her term of address with disfavour.
"Brandy."
He was in no mood for the niceties.
"You want the bottle, ducks?"
She had recognised his need.
"Well, that'll do for a start," he agreed.
He drank 3 large brandies, and with a faint dismay knew that they were having no effect, apart from sharpening his imagination to the point where he could clearly see Ruth's face before his eyes, complete in every detail down to the little black beauty spot high on her cheek, and the way the corners of her eyes slanted upwards as she smiled. He would have to make a more active approach to forgetfulness. Leaning back, with both elbows on the counter and the glass clutched in his right hand, he studied the men about him once more, evaluating each of them as a source of distraction, and then discarding and moving his attention on. He was finally left with the small group around the gaming table. 7 players, the game draw poker, and from what he could see the stakes were modest. He picked up his bottle, crossed the room to join the circle of spectators, and took up his position behind a sergeant of yeomanry, who was receiving a battering from the cards. A few hands later, the sergeant drew one to fill his flush, missed, and pushed the bluff, raising twice until he was called by two pairs across the table. He threw his hand in and blew through his lips in disgust.
"Yeah, that cleans me out."
He gathered the few coins left on the table in front of him and stood up.
"Rough luck, Jack. Anyone care to take his place?"
The winner looked around the circle of spectators.
"Nice friendly little game. Table stakes?"
"Deal me in."
Sean sat down, placed his glass and bottle strategically at his right hand and stacked 5 gold sovereigns in front of him.
"The man's got gold. Welcome."
Sean ducked the first hand, lost £2 to 3 queens on the next, and won £5 on the third. The pattern of his luck was set. He played with cold single-mindedness, and when he wanted cards, it seemed he had only to wish for them. What was the old adage? Unlucky in love, and the cards turn hot. Sean grinned without amusement, and filled a small straight with the 5 of hearts, beat down the 3 sevens that came against him, and drew the pot towards him to swell the pile of his winnings. Up about 30 or 40 pounds, he was enjoying himself now. A small school, gentlemen. 3 players had dropped out in the last hour, leaving 4 of them at the table.
How about giving those losers a chance to recoup?
You want to raise the stakes? Sean asked the speaker.
He was the only other winner, a big man with a red face and the smell of horses about him. Transport rider, probably.
Yeah, if everyone agrees, make the minimum bet £5.
Suits me, grunted Sean, and there was a murmur of agreement around the table.
With heavy money out, an air of caution prevailed at first, but slowly the game opened up. Sean's luck cooled a little, but an hour later he had built up his kitty on a series of small wins to a total of £75. Then Sean dealt a strange hand. The first caller on Sean's left raised before the draw, and was raised in turn by the gentleman with the horsey smell. Number 3 called, and Sean fanned his cards open. With a gentle elation, he found the 7, 8, 9, and 10 of clubs with a diamond 6. A pretty little straight dealt pat.
Call your 20 and raise it 20, he offered,
and there was a small stir of excitement among the onlookers.
Call.
Number 1 was short of cash. Call, echoed horse odour, and his gold clinked into the pot.
I'm dropping.
Number 3 closed his cards and pushed them away. Sean turned back to number 1.
How many cards?
I'll play with these.
Sean felt the first premonition of disaster.
And you?
He asked horse odour.
I'm also happy with what I have.
2 pat hands against his small straight. And from the suit distribution, Sean's 4 clubs. One of them would certainly be a flush. With a queasy feeling in his stomach, Sean knew he was in trouble, knew his hand to be a loser. Break the straight and go for the other club. Still not a certain winner, but the only thing worth trying.
I'll draw one.
He tossed the 6 of diamonds into the welter of discards and dealt to himself from the top of the pack.
My bet.
Number 1's face was glowing with confidence.
I'll raise the minimum, another 40. Cost you £80 to look at me, boys. Let's see the colour of your money. I'd like to push you, but that's the limit. I'll call.
Horse Odor's expression was completely neutral, but he was sweating in a light sheen across his forehead.
Let me go to the books,
Sean picked up his cards, and from behind the other 4, pressed out the corner of the table he had drawn. It was black. He opened it a little more. A black 6. Slowly he felt the pressure build up within him, like a freshly fired boiler. He drew a long breath and opened the card fully.
I'll call also,
he spoke on a gusty, outgoing breath.
Full house, shouted number 1. Queen's full, beat that, you bastards.
Horse Odor slapped his cards down viciously, his red face crumbling in disappointment.
God damn it, of all the filthy luck. I had an ace high flush,
number 1 giggled with excitement and reached for the money.
Wait for it, friend, Sean advised him, and spread his cards face up upon the table.
It's a flush.
My full house beats you, protested number one.
Count the pips. Sean touched each card as he named them. 6, 7, 8, 9, and the 10, all clubs, straight flush.
You come second by a day's march. He lifted number one's hands off the money, pulled it towards him, and began stacking it in columns of 20.
Pretty hot run of luck you're having,
Horse Odo gave his opinion, his face still twisted with disappointment.
Yes, agreed Sean. £268, very pretty.
Funny how it comes to you on the big hands, Horse Odo went on, and especially when you're dealing. What did you say your profession was?
Without looking up, Sean began transferring the stacks of sovereigns to his pocket. He was smiling a little. The end to a perfect evening, he decided.
Satisfied that the money was secure, Sean looked up at Horse Odo and turned that smile full upon him.
Come along then, laddie, he said. It'll be a pleasure.
Horse Odo shoved his chair back and stood up.
It will indeed, agreed Sean.
Horse Odo led down the back stairs into the yard, followed by Sean and the entire clientele of the canteen. At the bottom he paused, judging Sean's footstep on the wooden stairs behind him. Then he spun and hit, swinging his body into the punch. Sean rolled his head, but it caught him on the temple, and he went over backwards into the crowd behind him. As he fell, he saw Horse Odo jerk back the tail of his jacket and bring out the knife. It shone dull silver in the light from the canteen windows. Skinning knife, curved 8 inches of blade. The crowd scattered, leaving Sean lying on the stairs. And Horse Odo came in to kill him, making an ugly sound, bringing the knife arching down from overhead, a clumsy, unprofessional blow. Only slightly stunned, Sean followed the silver sweep of the knife with ease, and the man's wrist slapped loudly into Sean's open left hand. For a long moment, the man lay on top of Sean, his knife arm helpless in Sean's grip, while Sean assessed his strength, and with regret realized it was no match. Horse Odo was big enough, but the belly pressed against Sean's was flabby and large, and the wrist in Sean's hand was bony, without the hard, rubbery give of sinew and muscle. Horse Odo started to struggle, trying to wrestle his knife arm free. The sweat dewed on his face and then began to drip. It had an oily, unpleasant smell, like rancid butter, that blended poorly with the odour of horses. Sean tightened his grip on the man's wrist, at first using only the strength of his forearm.
Ah!
Horse Odo stopped struggling. Sean brought in the power of his whole arm, so he could feel his shoulder muscles bunching and writhing.
Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ!
Shrieking, as bone cracked in his wrist, Horse Odor's fingers sprang open and the knife thumped onto the wooden stairs. Still holding him, Sean sat up, then came slowly to his feet.
Leave us, friend.
Sean flung him backwards into the dust of the yard. He was breathing easily, still feeling cold and detached, as he looked down and watched Horse Odor scrabbling to his knees, nursing his broken wrist. Perhaps it was the man's first movement towards flight that triggered Sean. Or perhaps it was the liquor he had drunk that twisted his emotions, aggravated his sense of loss and frustration, and channeled it into this insane outburst of hatred. Suddenly it seemed to Sean that here before him on the ground was the source of all his ills. This was the man who had taken Ruth from him.
You bastard, he growled.
The man sensed the change in Sean and scrambled to his feet, his face turning desperately from side to side as he sought an avenue of escape.
You filthy bastard!
Sean's voice rose, shrill with the strength of this new emotion. For the first time in his life, Sean craved to kill. He advanced upon the man slowly, his fists opening and closing, his face contorted, and the words that spilled from his mouth no longer making sense. A great stillness had fallen upon the yard. In the shadows, the watchers stood, chilled with the dreadful fascination of it. The man was frozen also. Only his head moved, and no sound came from his open lips. And Sean closed in with the weaving motion of a cobra in erection. At the last moment, the man tried to run, but his legs were slack and heavy with fear, and Sean hit him in the chest with a sound like an axe swung against a tree trunk.
As he fell, Sean went in after him, straddling his chest, roaring incoherently, with only a single word recognizable, the name of the woman he loved. In his madness, he felt the man's face breaking up under his fists, felt the warm splatter of blood thrown into his own face and onto his arms, and heard the shouts of the crowd. "He'll kill him! Get him off! For Christ's sake, give me a hand! He's as strong as a bloody ox!" Their hands upon him, an arm locked around his throat from behind, the shock as someone hit him with a bottle, the press of their bodies as they swarmed over him. With men clinging to him, two of them riding his back, and a dozen others on his arms and legs, Sean came to his feet. "Pull his legs out from under him! Get him down, man! Get him down!" With a convulsive heave, Sean swung the men on his arms into violent collision with each other. They released him. He kicked his right leg free, and those on his other leg let go and scattered. Reaching over his shoulders, he plucked the men off his back and stood alone, his chest swelling and subsiding as he breathed, the blood from the bottle gash in his scalp trickling down his face and soaking into his beard. "Get a gun!" someone shouted. "There's a shotgun under the bar!" But no one left the circle that ringed him in, and Sean glared around at them, his eyes staring wildly from the plain of glistening blood that was his face. "You've killed him!" a voice accused him. And the words reached Sean through the madness. His body relaxed slightly, and he tried to wipe away the blood with the open palm of his hand. They saw the change in him. "Cool down, mate. Fun's fun, but the hell with murder. Easy now, easy now. Let's have a look at what you've done to him." Sean looked down on the body, and he was confused and then suddenly afraid. The man was dead. He was certain of it. "Oh, my God," he whispered, backing away, wiping at his eyes ineffectually and smearing blood. "He pulled a knife. Don't worry, mate. You've got witnesses." The temper of the crowd had changed. "No," Sean mumbled. They didn't understand. For the first time in his life, he had abused his strength, had used it to kill without purpose, to kill for the pleasure of it, to kill in the manner in which a leopard kills. Then the man moved slightly. He rolled his head, and one of his legs flexed and straightened. Sean felt hope leap within him. "He's alive! Get a doctor!" Fearfully, Sean approached and knelt beside the man. He unknotted the scarf from around his own throat and cleaned the bloody mouth and nostrils. "He'll be all right. Leave him to the doc." The doctor came, a lean and laconic man, chewing tobacco. In the yellow light of a hurricane lamp, he examined and prodded, while they crowded close about him, craning to see over his shoulders. At last the doctor stood up. "All right, he can be moved. Carry him up to my surgery." Then he looked at Sean. "Did you do it?" Sean nodded. "Remind me not to annoy you." I didn't mean to. It just sort of happened." "Is that so?" The doctor shot a stream of yellow tobacco juice into the dust of the yard. "Let's have a look at your head." He pulled Sean's head down to his own level and parted the sodden black hair. "Nicked a vein. Doesn't need a stitch. Wash it, and then a little iodine." "How much, doc, for the other fellow?" Sean asked. "You paying?" The doctor looked at him quizzically. "Yes. Broken jaw, broken collarbone, about 24 stitches, and a few days in bed for concussion," he mused, adding it up. "Say, 2 guineas? Sean gave him 5. "Look after him, doc." "Well, that's my job." And he followed the men who were carrying horse odour out of the yard. "I guess you need a drink, mister." "I'll buy you one," someone offered. "The whole world loves a winner." "Yes," agreed Sean. "I need a drink." Sean had more than one drink. When Imbijani came to fetch him at midnight, he had a deal of difficulty getting Sean up onto the back of the horse. Halfway to the camp, Sean slid off and subsided into the road, so Imbijani loaded him sideways, head and arms hanging over to port and legs dangling starboard. "It is possible that tomorrow you will regret this," Imbijani told him primly, as he unloaded him beside the fire and rolled him, still booted and bloody, into his blanket. And he was correct.